This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iraqi official pledges cooperation and quick action against militants in Mosul. An open letter to the UN Secretary General on the crisis in Libya. The outgoing UN rights chief deplores international indifference to atrocities. The Thai junta asks diplomats to soften coup's image abroad. And Americans are divided over a soldier's release in exchange for Taliban fighters.
We're glad he's free after 5 years.
He didn't serve with honor and dignity and respect, and he is a deserter.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Iraq's foreign minister, Hoshyar Zebari, says the government in Baghdad will work with Kurdish authorities in the north to push insurgents out of Mosul after Islamist militants seize control of the city. Zebari said today that Iraq's leaders must unite to face what he called a serious, mortal threat facing the country. He pledged a quick response to Tuesday's seizure of Iraq's second-largest city, which was a stunning defeat for the country's Shiite-led government. The International Organization for Migration said today that fears of further violence in Mosul caused 500,000 people to flee their homes. It said the displaced either moved across the city or fled to other parts of Nineveh province or the neighboring Kurdish province of Erbil. The Obama administration says Syrian-based militants who have seized control of Mosul present a broader regional threat that needs to have a more unified Iraqi government to subdue. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki says the growing strength in Syria of the al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant aided the militants' capture of Mosul.
We've seen from the situation in Syria and the overflow of the impact of that, that there have been an impact on the transfer and its recruits, sophisticated munitions and resources to the fight in Iraq. And that has, of course, been of great concern to us.
Psaki says the loss of Iraq's second-largest city, along with other parts of Nineveh province, show a serious deterioration of Iraqi security and a resurgent ISIL threat that benefits from political divisions among Iraqi Sunni, Shia, and Kurds.
The threat that ISIL is presenting is not just a threat to Iraq or the stability of Iraq, but it is a threat to the region. And this growing menace exemplifies the importance of Iraqis from all communities working together to confront this common enemy.
Asked about reports that some security forces in Mosul abandoned their posts, Psaki said events there are being closely tracked by officials in Washington and Baghdad, as well as in Iraq's semi-autonomous northern Kurdish region.
In terms of those specific reports, we continue to consult with the government of Iraq on those details. There are a range of Iraqi security forces that remain engaged, and we continue to work with them to address the security situation.
Psaki says the Obama administration has notified Congress of another $1 billion in proposed arms sales to Iraq to include up to 200 Humvees. That's in addition to the 300 Hellfire missiles, small arms and tank ammunition, machine guns, rifles, helicopters, and helicopter-fired rockets that have been sent to Baghdad over the past year. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
Karim Mezran, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East, along with several other analysts, have written an open letter to the UN Secretary General concerning Libya. In it, they call for immediate support to avert civil war in that nation. We asked Karim Mezran what that support would entail.
Our idea was to call for the United Nations to become a coordinator for international community mediation, to put together the various Libyan forces to sit around the table and negotiate a way out of this crisis. Because we thought that Libyans themselves could not do that. So a foreign mediator with the authority of the United Nations could obtain something the Libyans themselves could not do. That is, to reach an agreement around political solution to the crisis, rather than avoid talking and acting the way General Haftar acted, unleashing war and battle.
Your letter calls for the establishment of a new legislative body. What would that be responsible for?
It would be a new parliament, take the place of the actual GNC, so that they could rule the country. In the sense that the new legislator would have the legitimacy that the actual assembly doesn't have, and appoint a new government, which would be possibly in that case a product of a consensus of a national will of the whole population, and in that way start resolving the issues and the problems that the GNC cannot undertake.
Would this include a new constitution?
The new constitution is not the task of a new parliament. We have already elected a constitutional assembly, constitutional committee, as it is called. It is headed by Ali Tarhouni, and this committee is responsible to write the constitution, which then will be approved by national referendum by the people. So the new parliament will not have to do the constitution, but will have to administer the country and appoint a new government, enact laws, and restart the economy and bring all back order to the country. There are two very different results.
You also call for strengthening Libya's national army. Why?
Libya needs its own security forces that are dependent on the structure of the state, that are loyal to the state, and that work for the state, and not armed forces that depend on local militias, strange commanders, and response to other interests that are not those of the national state.
Karim Mezran, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, has issued a stinging rebuke to the international community for remaining indifferent to widespread atrocities committed around the world. In a final speech to the UN Human Rights Council before leaving her post, Pillay said politics has too often taken precedence over human rights. Lisa Schlein reports from the Council in Geneva.
Navi Pillay will have served 6 years as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights when she steps down on September 1st. Throughout her tenure, she has been an outspoken champion of human rights, often risking offending countries by maintaining pressure on governments she deemed culpable of gross, systematic abuse. She did not soften this approach as she deplored the sad state of human rights around the world in her final speech to the 47-member UN Human Rights Council.
Regrettably, the international community remains unable to consistently react strongly and quickly to crises, including situations of grave human rights violations with high potential for regional overspill.
Pillay visited South Sudan in April, a week after the violence and mass slaughter there reached new heights. She said she was shocked by the targeted ethnic attacks and risk of widespread famine, as well as by the seeming indifference of the leaders on both sides of the conflict to this unfolding tragedy. She expressed similar feelings of outrage and alarm at the intercommunal tensions and widespread violence in the Central African Republic. She described the relentless violence in Syria as a tragedy for the Syrian people and a tragic failure for the cause of human rights. She said the bombings, widespread loss of life, and extensive damage to infrastructure in such places as Aleppo should outrage the conscience of humanity. She deplored the willful refusal by Syria's government and some opposition groups to seek a peaceful solution to end the war.
External powers continue to fuel this violence through the supply of arms, military and other material assistance, as well as inflows of foreign fighters. It is shocking that war crimes and crimes against humanity have become commonplace and occur with complete impunity. I am disappointed that the Security Council, with 13 votes in favor and 2 opposed, has been unable to reach agreement on action to ensure accountability for such crimes.
Russia and China have repeatedly vetoed resolutions aimed at referring Syrian officials suspected of war crimes and crimes against humanity to the International Criminal Court. In her speech, Pillay indicated that violations of human rights involve more than just large-scale abuses, saying human rights starts and ends with the individual. She poignantly highlighted the abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls by the militant Boko Haram in Nigeria. She cited the so-called honor killing in Pakistan of a 23-year-old pregnant woman by her family as another shocking case of violence against women. As she prepares to step down as UN Rights Chief, Pillay leaves a full agenda of human rights violations for her successor, including the deteriorating situation in Ukraine. She leaves while the UN sets up a field office in South Korea to monitor widespread abuses in North Korea. She leaves as her office prepares a comprehensive investigation into alleged atrocities committed in the waning days of Sri Lanka's long civil war with the Tamil Tigers, and with Sri Lanka's government vowing once again not to cooperate with the UN probe. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The leader of Thailand's junta gave instructions today to some of the country's top diplomats to seek international understanding for the coup he carried out last month. Meanwhile, a delegation of military commanders has been dispatched to Beijing for a conference with high-level Chinese army officials. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
General Prayut Chan-o-cha, who now holds all executive and legislative power in Thailand, met at Army headquarters Wednesday with 23 of the country's ambassadors and general consuls deployed in 21 countries. The general, according to spokespersons for the junta and the foreign ministry, told the diplomats that they have a duty to create international understanding about the May 22nd coup, and he would like ambassadors and government officials to help explain, formally and informally. Kyoto University Associate Professor Pavin Chachavalpongpun asserts Thailand's diplomats also have been given more ominous orders from the military.
There is a conflicting policy of using this ambassador, consul general, to put pressure on the host country to try to shut up critics of the coup who live overseas, be they political activists or academic like myself, even to the point of trying to use their influence to force the host country to deport these people.
Pavin calls the decrees targeting freedom of academic and other types of expression a violation of basic human rights. Since the May 22nd coup and the establishment of the National Council for Peace and Order to run the country, several hundred people have been detained. They include politicians, activists, academics, and journalists. Many have been released after being interrogated and held incommunicado for a week or two in military camps. Some have defied summons, which continue to be issued, to turn themselves in. Among them are some Thais living outside the country, including Pavin in Japan. As the general met with the country's diplomats, a delegation of Thai military commanders were on their way to China. They are to discuss with top-level Chinese army officials regional security and future joint training exercises. The two countries have conducted joint exercises in the past. The top representative at the conference for China is expected to be Lieutenant General Wang Guanzhong, deputy chief of the General Staff of the People's Liberation Army. The Thai junta says China has been supportive of the coup carried out by the army chief. Thailand's Deputy Permanent Secretary for Defense, General Surasak Kanjanarat, said the meeting in Beijing will map out future plans of action with the PLA. A move to strengthen ties between Bangkok and Beijing comes after Western nations, including the United States, a longtime ally of Thailand, have been critical of the May 22nd coup. The U.S. military ceased training maneuvers with Thailand's forces in response to the coup. Professor Pavin in Japan says due to their geographical proximity and burgeoning economic ties, the post-coup mutual embrace between Thailand and China is pragmatic and a win-win situation.
The pressure from Western countries, United States and Australia, could have played a role in pushing Thailand a little bit closer to China, and knowing that there would be a lot of interest in so doing anyway.
Bilateral trade is expected to top $100 billion next year, with China already Thailand's largest trading partner. The junta in Bangkok says China is among several countries which have expressed understanding of the reasons for last month's military takeover. General Prayut has expressed a need to return happiness to the Thai people after a long and unsettling period of political chaos. A junta spokesman in a VOA interview subsequent to the coup said a primary goal for the overthrow of the civilian caretaker government is to permanently eradicate the influence from politics of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. He was deposed in a 2006 coup, but the party he backed won the 2011 election, and Thaksin's sister, Yingluck Shinawat, later became prime minister. Parties backed by the wealthy family have won every national election in Thailand since 2001, primarily due to support at the ballot box from the northern rural poor. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
German-based manufacturer Gros Becker is set to become the first foreign firm to take part in the inter-Korean Kaesong Industrial Complex since 2008, more than a year after North Korea withdrew all its workers amid inter-Korean tensions over its third nuclear test in February 2013. The company, the largest supplier of industrial needles and related textile manufacturing tools and services, will set up a sales office at Kaesong, located inside North Korea and involving about 120 South Korean factories employing over 50,000 North Korean workers. Troy Stagiron, Senior Director for Congressional Affairs and Trade at the Korean Economic Institute, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while the company's involvement is minimal, this is an important first step for Kaesong after it was reopened in September.
One of the challenges facing Kaesong is until someone was willing to go first, a lot of companies might consider it, but you sort of need the confidence of seeing that someone else can successfully do it. So if this goes through and if they're successful, I think it could be an important step forward.
Do we have any other sign of other companies that are considering going in?
There's been talk about various companies. A Norwegian delegation went a little while back. You've heard stories of the Chinese going. I think there was a German delegation. There was talk that one German firm that already did business with one of the companies in Kaesong would take and buy into that company as a way to take part in sort of Kaesong. So there's been a lot of talk about different firms sort of kicking the tires on this, but up until now, no one seemed ready to commit.
Well, we've talked before about Kaesong and, of course, the fact that it was shuttered last year by North Korea. This is a risky move by this German company.
I think to a large degree, the risks in this case are minimal. They're not, from what I've read, opening up a factory. What they're doing is they're opening up an office to sell their industrial needles to the textile manufacturers there. They wouldn't seem to be at risk of a shutdown impacting their production and hence orders and profits elsewhere. They would only lose potential sales to the South Korean firms in Kaesong during a shutdown. And this also means that because they're going to be selling to South Korean firms, you probably would not face the type of reputational risks some firms are probably concerned about because you wouldn't be using North Korean labor to make anything. You're simply supplying essentially an industrial good to the South Korean companies. So I think to a large extent, this is probably minimal risk for them.
If other firms outside of the Koreas step into Kaesong, will this make it harder for North Korea to shut it down?
It'll depend on where those firms are from, I think, and what those firms are doing. And what I mean by that is that by adding international firms, you raise a degree of pressure on North Korea because now you have the prospect of other foreign governments becoming involved in placing pressure on North Korea to not simply play political games with the complex. But that being said, I'm not sure at this point if it's firms other than perhaps from China, how much impact it will have. There's a story that when the first time North Korea shut down the border for a couple of days, that there were Chinese businessmen in Kaesong considering investment, and that Pyongyang didn't realize that and that they quickly sort of panicked and found a way to get them out of the country safely. But I think the broad perspective is that ultimately Kaesong is on North Korean soil. If North Korea decides that politically they need to shut it down, they'll understand that there's greater political risk for them in doing so with foreign firms there. But it does not preclude them from ultimately taking the action, unfortunately.
Sangaron says it is in Pyongyang's interest to keep the joint venture open, as it is a key source of hard currency, employment, and a source of management industrial skills. Following last year's five-month suspension, Kaesong, which opened in 2004, is now operated by a joint North-South Management Committee.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit VOAfootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at VOAfootball.com.
American public opinion is divided about the swap of five Taliban prisoners for a U.S. soldier who who was held captive by the Taliban in Afghanistan for nearly 5 years. Opponents have questioned the circumstances of the soldier's capture and fear the exchange will encourage hostage takers worldwide. Supporters say that no American should be left behind, no matter what the cost. Zlata Sahok reports that one place where Americans stand firmly by Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is his hometown in the western U.S. state of Idaho.
Welcoming banners hang around Haley, a small town in southern Idaho, where many remember Sergeant Bergdahl as a boy.
Bo was a Haley-raised kid, and I think that people in Haley stick by their own until they have reason not to do it.
Residents were thrilled to hear of Bergdahl's rescue and were planning a celebration for him, until they started receiving disparaging messages from around the country.
We've gotten hate mail. We're being called Traitor Town in Haley, Idaho, because we support a young man that came from this community and that we're glad he's free after 5 years.
Bergdahl went missing in June 2009 in Afghanistan's Paktika province, where he was deployed. Some fellow soldiers testified he walked off base and into hostile territory by choice. Joshua Cornelison was a medic in Bergdahl's unit.
So we just want people to realize that he is not an American hero, that he didn't serve with honor and dignity and respect, and he is a deserter in a time of war. That's it. That's the whole message.
Some who say they will not judge Bergdahl's actions before the circumstances of his capture are clear criticize the administration's decision to release 5 potentially dangerous prisoners for a captured soldier. Thriller novel author Scott McEwan spoke to VOA via Skype from San Diego.
There's a difference between, you know, leaving someone there and not and letting go 5 major lieutenants / captains of a terrorist group. I think that there's many things you could have done in between.
The swap has sparked resentment in some Afghan communities still scarred from Taliban attacks in the late 1990s. Farmer Abdul Karim remembers the attack on his village of Desaki.
The Taliban took our children and wives through Jalalabad to Pakistan and imprisoned us in Pulacharki jail. They burned down all our homes.
The exchange has become a political game of football between Republicans and Democrats in the U.S. Congress. Republican House Speaker John Boehner said he was glad Bergdahl was free, but condemned the swap.
The biggest issue here is the violation of a policy that the United States has had for many, many years, that we don't negotiate with terrorists.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel is set to testify before a congressional panel Wednesday.
Our first priority is assuring his well-being and his health and getting him reunited with his family.
Hagel said Bergdahl's case will be examined in detail after he has recovered. In Haley, residents wish him a speedy recovery. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Representative Eric Cantor, the majority leader of the Republican-controlled House, suffered a shocking defeat in a primary race for re-election to his congressional seat in Virginia Tuesday. Cantor was soundly beaten by David Bratt, an economics professor at a small college who is backed by the ultra-conservative Tea Party movement. Bratt raised little money but gained support from both voters and conservative media personalities by accusing Cantor of supporting a plan to grant illegal immigrants in the U.S. an easy path to citizenship, which opponents have criticized as an amnesty. Many political observers say Cantor's upset loss has scuttled any chance of passing legislation to reform the nation's immigration system. Addressing his supporters Tuesday night, Cantor called his loss disappointing, but stressed that he believes there is an opportunity around the next corner. The 51-year-old Cantor was first elected to the House in 2000 from a district that includes Richmond, Virginia's capital city. He rose quickly through the Republican leadership ranks and earned support among Tea Party lawmakers for his demands to cut government spending. Cantor was considered likely to replace House Speaker John Boehner after the November congressional elections. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1509, King Henry VIII of England married Catherine of Aragon. That was the first of his six wives. On June 11, 1776, the first representative government of colonial America, the Continental Congress, named a committee to draft a Declaration of Independence from Britain. Selected by the committee to write the document, Virginia delegate Thomas Jefferson crafted a statement expressing the colonists' grievances against the king. The Continental Congress adopted Jefferson's declaration on July 4th, the day now celebrated by the United States as Independence Day. On this day in 1770, British explorer Captain James Cook became the first European to discover the Great Barrier Reef off Australia, but he did so by accident. His ship ran aground on the world's largest coral reef. In 1963, two black Americans, Vivian Malone and James Hood, enrolled at the University of Alabama in a dispute over racial segregation at colleges in the southern U.S. The two were allowed to enroll even though Alabama Governor George Wallace stood defiantly in the school's entrance to keep them from entering. Also in 1963, a Buddhist monk publicly burned himself to death in a plea for Vietnam's President Diem to show charity and compassion to all religions. Diem, a Catholic, had been oppressing the Buddhist majority. On this day in 1979, actor John Wayne died of cancer at the age of 72. Two of Steven Spielberg's classic movies debuted on this day. In 1982, E.T. the Extraterrestrial dazzled audiences, and in 1993, Jurassic Park took viewers to a land where dinosaurs had been brought back into existence. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
3 years of conflict in Syria have taken an enormous toll on the population inside the country and beyond its borders. More than 162,000 people have been killed. Of the country's estimated pre-war population of approximately 20 million people, 9.3 million are in need of aid, with some 4 million lacking even basic necessities such as food. More than 6 million are internally displaced, refugees within their own country, while an additional more than 2.8 million have left for neighboring countries, with many living in host communities and camps. Of Syria's neighbors, Lebanon has been the most deeply impacted by the influx of refugees fleeing the violence, with over 1.1 million registered refugees from Syria. And that is one reason why Secretary of State John Kerry took the opportunity to announce during a June 4th visit to Lebanon an additional $290 million in humanitarian assistance for the Syria response, which will help people inside Syria and also the countries that host refugees who have fled the violence. With this new assistance, the United States is now providing more than $2 billion in response to this humanitarian crisis, said Secretary Kerry.
There is still an enormous need on the ground that is not being met. And I'm not going to stand up here and pretend that the $2 billion or the money we're giving today is enough. Also, for those refugees, just being supported in a refugee camp is not enough. It doesn't change their lives. It doesn't end the war. It doesn't speak to their day-to-day sense of loss and abandonment. And it certainly doesn't provide them with the long-term security and opportunity that they deserve.
All of us, all nations, have a responsibility to try to end this conflict, said Secretary Kerry, calling particularly on those nations directly supporting the Assad regime to work with the international community and bring the Syria conflict to an end. He also called on international donors to deliver to the Syrian people aid that they had pledged. It is critically important now, he said, to support Lebanon and to support others in the region who are suffering the consequences of this humanitarian crisis. I am very proud, said Secretary Kerry, that the United States of America is leading the charge and responding to this moral and this security imperative.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.